go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Okay, first things first, to wit, there is apparently a problem with the Horn chat room. The bill is paid, it's more than current, and it's, oddly enough, nothing to do with the Horn website. It apparently has to do with the company that provides it, Add-On. And, here's the technical diagnosis for what's wrong with the Horn chat room. It doesn't work. There. Okay, yeah. And we're trying to find out why, but as Lottie told me earlier today, you can't even contact Add-On because they're down too. Oi. Another day in paradise. But, so I'll let you know when I hear otherwise. On the other hand, over at headonradionetwork.com, something else works, and that's the Contribute tab. I just checked it out. It works. And remember, we have a challenge on the table from Tony in Chico, one of our longest-standing subscribers, who is trying to help us build the formidable 400, named courtesy of Shirley in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Tony will match the first $10 of 10 brand new subscribers. And thank you to our buddy Gary Laborman for becoming one of those subscribers. We're trying to reach the first 100 of the formidable 400. And Laborman, Gary, signed up earlier today, and that is incredibly helpful, very helpful indeed. All you got to do that is go over to, and remember, and this is also contingent upon Agnes and me sitting down with a bunch of envelopes and a bunch of stamps and a bunch of, a couple of pens and a bunch of bumper stickers. We will start getting them out in fairly short order. Because right now all of our efforts are focused in a slightly different direction. More on that in a moment. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I don't know why it is I always forget that part. But anyway, the next 9 brand new $10 a month subscribers get their subscriptions doubled for the first month, courtesy of Tony and Chico. Laborman jumped in, and we've got 9 more spaces to fill, and you'll get your subscription doubled for the first month. Isn't that awesome? Thank you, Tony. Thank you. And we closed last night down $130 in fundraising, and I wanted to let you know that I heard from Chris in Germany earlier today, and Chris asked a couple of questions, which I tried to answer. And this is all by the way of sort of program notes, scheduling, that kind of thing. One, there will be no program tomorrow evening. I had planned for there to be no program tomorrow evening because we were going to be doing the live poetry, prose, and plain song program from Secret Sandwich Society. Now, that's not going to happen either. No. What's going to be happening is we're going to be doing some very, very, very serious engineering work here in the studio. A good friend of mine who helped wire up the original studio way, way back 10 years ago is coming by almost like a 10th birthday party to wire up some gizmos that will relate to our ability to fill in for Mike Malloy, which will start next week if everything goes okay. Just to let you know where everything stands, I tested some of the equipment earlier today, but we've got to test more and get more hooked up, and that will happen tomorrow evening. So no program tomorrow evening. Thursday and Friday should be typical. Next week, no programs. Not because it's Thanksgiving or holiday, or Agnes and I are heading to Stad for the season. No, none of that. Next week there will be no programs because instead of doing 3 hours of this, I'll be doing 3 hours of Mike Malloy. Cross your fingers that all the tech works out, but that's the plan. And I'm excited as heck about that. I don't know about you, but I am. So that's where that stands. So that means that we're going to be in a bit of a fundraising pickle. And so consequently, Chris in Germany has put a challenge on the table. We have $330 to raise this evening, but through the end of the week, and this is important, through the end of the week, Chris has offered to match the next $500 that come in. And that is huge. And thank you so very much to Chris for doing that, because that's how we keep all this on the air and keep it all going. And good God, we're up to our eyeballs in bills, and we always are, because this isn't an effort to buy anybody's Gulfstream jet aircraft. And well, the pool boy and the cabana boy are beginning to give Agnes some sidelong glances. It's been a while since they got paid, you know what I mean? All right. So there's a $500 challenge on the table, and there is a challenge courtesy of Tony to match the next $10 a month contributions for the first month. In other words, you sign up for a brand new subscription, and it's for $10, and Tony is going to double that the first time through. After that, you know, I mean, and that's extremely generous. We need to raise the $330 this evening, ever so badly, and hopefully that'll happen and I can shut up. And by the way, this is also, this here, 17th of November, 2015, is the final night of the Don't Say Uh-uh Challenge. Carol tells me if we get through tonight, it will have cost her $80. It will have cost even more to Gerald, because his prestige is significantly on the line, not having won the, you know, that guy challenge for a week. Exactly. So all told, there's everything in place that we could catch up with last night, take care of tonight, not worry about tomorrow, and be a long way toward getting a lot of, well, because next week is going to be, you know, tough. So there you have it. But I wanted to let everybody know what the scheduling is going to be like. And the contribution or subscription process over at headonradionetwork.com is really easy. First thing you see when you click the contribute tab is how much you want to kick in. And then there's a box you can check that says, I would like this to make this donation to automatically repeat each month. And boom, you do that. And then you put in your name, and you don't have to put in your employer or your occupation. And then you get to the bottom, and there's a PayPal button. You click that, and you get to the next screen, and it tells you, you know, that's where you can choose between your PayPal account and your Visa, MasterCard, American Express, etc., etc. So I really hope I don't end up having to mention that anymore. Wouldn't that be awesome? Yes, it would be. It is, of course, Titanic Tuesday on the horn. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And you may recall that Titanic Tuesday is named for the Titanic intellect that is associated with right-wing attempts at cognition. It gets its name from something that was now said several years ago by West Virginia's most accomplished monotone, who would read the newspaper to his knuckle-breathing, mouth-walking faithful, and occasionally take calls, one of which came through one day in which the caller said, "Steve, how come you reckon it is that they is seashells in the rocks in West Virginia? We ain't nowhere near the ocean." To which Steve-O confidently replied, "Well, caller, that's because of the movement of the Titanic plates." The Titanic plates, yes. No word yet on the movement of the Titanic melon baller. No. But it's emblematic of the delightful confidence with which the right wing goes about being the manifest idiots that they are. So that's what we celebrate on Titanic Tuesdays, if we're not celebrating, we're at least observing, right? Let's see. Jack in Shreveport, with regard to the Horn Chat, notes, "Horn Chat probably depends on some type of central server, so I bet Horn Chat will fix itself when add-on fixes their problem." I tend to agree, Jack. I think this is an add-on problem, but the thing is, add-on is driven by Java, at least the version we were using. And Java has become just a wonderland of bizarreness, with computers not cooperating, it not cooperating with computers. It's a mess. By the way, a note from a longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Lottie. He says he talked to Greg, you know who Greg is, and Greg over at MikeMalloy.com said he'd be happy for us to come in and use that chat. Lottie says, "I'm in there now. Please let people know." If you just go to MikeMalloy.com and click on, let me see exactly what the words are there. If you go to MikeMalloy.com and click Truth Seeker Chat Room. MikeMalloy.com, Truth Seeker Chat Room. It will take you right there. Pick out a screen name and pick out a password and hit sign in, and like me, you'll be there. And there's Greg and there's Lottie. And how in God's name do I turn off the noise? And folks are wandering in even now. Hey, there's Irish Dave. There's Devin. There's Laborman. Wonderful. Yeah, this one's also powered by add-on, but it's not quite the train wreck that their Java-based stuff is right now. So we're gathering in an alternative chat room at the moment, until add-on gets its act together. So that means at 14 minutes past the hour, we can go about the business of getting into the meat of the evening's programming. And as far as Titanic intellect goes, there's going to be a whole bunch. A ton, in fact. You just knew, didn't you? And I admit to a morbid fascination with the issue, because I've wondered if other countries I prefer to think of as, and this is a complicated term, civilized, as in not the United States of America, because I don't think we can call ourselves civilized anymore. I mean, after all, one in four American children go to bed hungry every night. Civilized countries don't let that happen to their children. 1% of the entire population of the United States of America is behind bars. I don't think you can call a country civilized that does that to its people. Elderly, living in poverty. Working class. Dr. Bill, today in his program, which I have not yet put up on White Rose, but I will immediately after the program, just casually, because that's the way Dr. Bill is, he just casually mentions things that make you feel like you've had an axe handle in the back of the head. Mingo County, West Virginia, is one of those counties that was left behind by the prosperity that was promised by the coal industry. Half, and this is going, you're going to hear this and you're going to shake your head and you're going to hear the marbles rattling. What? Half of the employed people in Mingo County, West Virginia, do not have a high school diploma. Half. Those are the people with jobs. God only knows what the numbers are for the unemployed. Half of the employed people in Mingo County, West Virginia, don't have a high school diploma. Now, what Dr. Bill, the context about in which Dr. Bill was talking about this is absolutely fascinating, and you really, really do want to grab that podcast and give it a listen. It is 90 minutes of absolutely intellectually stimulating discussion. But again, in line with what I was getting at, a civilized country does not have that. No, no. And consequently, that's why I've taken to not considering the United States of America to be a civilized country. Among other things, civilized countries don't let other countries treat them like a resource colony. But we do. Civilized countries don't outsource their own workers' jobs to other countries. We do. So that's what I mean when I ask, do civilized countries have some of the same problems that the United States does? To wit, and in particular, are there French versions and or British versions or German versions or Swedish or Norwegian or Dutch or Danish or Italian or Spanish or Portuguese versions of what we call the truthers? Are there Australian truthers? Are there Japanese truthers, birthers, deathers? Is booger eating a worldwide phenomenon, or is that level of paranoia something that only, or that is, to use the phrase Dim Leader did back during the Reign of Error, uniquely American? I don't know. But I do know that I began to sort of wait, watch, and just sort of gird things up and have the hockey puck handy and a couple of strips of duct tape just fluttering off, stuck here and just fluttering like little pennants in the breeze off the edge of the desk for when I would need it. And it wasn't long. It really wasn't. Not very long at all, no. There is a website called Veterans Today. And at Veterans Today, don't go look. It has absolutely nothing to do with being a veteran. There's no articles in there about the failure of the VA system or the starvation of the VA system or the way that the Republican Party treats veterans like unwanted visitors. No. Veterans Today is a paranoia website run for the benefit of a dude by the name of Dr. probably couldn't put on a Band-Aid without killing someone, Kevin Barrett. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Barrett, there it is. Behold, ecce homo. Kevin Barrett has an article over at Veterans Today titled, Another French False Flag? Another? There was a first one? Well, of course there was a first one! Subtitled, 11th month, 11th district, Friday the 13th. And I admit, last Friday, I took note of the fact that it was Friday the 13th, and I took note of the fact that Friday the 13th is at least anecdotally associated with a group of crusaders from the Middle Ages, to wit, the Knights Templars. But that's about how our agreement goes. Kevin Barrett writes, and how long, really, has he been over onto the Alex Jones radio program, Merry-Go-Round of Madness yet? If not, why not? Alex is slipping if he hasn't. It happened on Friday the 13th, commemorating the massacre of the Proto-Illuminati Templars. Oh, no. Proto-Illuminatis? We've got Proto... Oh, dear. In the 11th month, in Paris's 11th district, it's going to be remembered as 11-13 or Friday the 13th. Illuminati numerology? Or coincidence? I vote coincidence. Nah, I don't know. For all I know, these creepies with lots of guns, maybe they're into that kind of stuff. Who can say? Because we don't really have anybody to ask. Hey, did you guys pick that date deliberately? No, that just happens to be when the bullets came in. They came in on the 12th, so we went on the 13th. No, actually, we were watching Pastor Steven Anders talking about how people who went to see the Eagles of Death Metal deserved to die, and being as how we're as fundamentalist as he is, we said, you know what? You're right, Steve. Kevin Barrett writes, I left Paris Friday at noon.
Wah, wah, wah.
As my plane landed in Chicago at 3:15 p.m. local time, 9:15 p.m. Paris time, the media was screaming, no, Kevin, you freaking idiot, the media were screaming, terrorists kill dozens in central Paris, hostages taken. The French military was occupying the City of Lights. It looks like another Charlie Hebdo situation, only bigger and bloodier. By eerie coincidence, that's how you get your eerie coincidences there with your imitation theremin music. At least I hope it was a coincidence. I spent Thursday evening walking around central Paris being interviewed about January's Charlie Hebdo false flag attacks. These bastards have figured out a way to, at heart, the truthers, deniers, whatever you want to call them, they truly are the most essential capitalists, aren't they? Yes. Because they will say, they will do anything for a buck. January's Charlie Hebdo false flag attacks? Yes! Why, yes! January's Charlie Hebdo false flag attacks. Those were fake dead people. You know, just like the fake little chopped up children at Sandy Hook. Just like the fake dead reporter in Virginia. Just like all those fake dead people all over America. Yeah. Little did I suspect that in less than 24 hours, an even bigger terror attack would rock the city. Filmmaker Vincent LaPierre of Égalité et Réconciliation filmed me at the Fontaine Saint-Michel in front of the Notre Dame Cathedral and in various left bank locations, as well as at E&R headquarters with leader Alain Soral. As I pontificated to the camera, at least he admits he was pontificating. That's generally not used as a positive term, is it? As I pontificated to the camera about false flag terror in general and Charlie Hebdo in particular, passers-by looked on with interest. One customer at the outdoor cafe table next to us told us she loved what she was hearing and appreciated the work we were doing. Well, that settles it now, doesn't it? The lady who, previous to that, was talking into her purse, started talking to them and said, "I love the things that I am hearing you say. You are," but he leaves off the part where she says, "You are even funnier than the Jerry Lewis. He is funniest person on the planet." Jerry Lewis. Since we now know the Charlie Hebdo attack was a Gladio II false flag by the usual suspects, NATO hardliners and Zionists, we can safely make the same assumption about these new Friday the 13th Paris atrocities? See, there are problems with Zionists out there. Who lives in the open-air concentration camp that is Gaza. Ask the Spanish, a Spanish judge recently issued a statement saying that he wishes to be informed should at any point in time Benjamin Netanyahu set foot on Spanish soil, because he would like to have him arrested and tried for war crimes for the attack on the Gaza flotilla. Let it go. I mean, don't let it go. It was a criminal act, but, you know, really? BB acts with impunity. But anyway, NATO hardliners and Zionists perpetrated the Gladio flag. Gladio 2, I don't know. I don't think it was as good as Gladio 1. Of course, Gladio 1 was just called Gladio. They didn't know it would be the box office smash that it was and lead to a sequel. I think we can, he says, make false flag assumptions about what happened last Friday. Almost every really big, spectacular terror attack turns out, after extensive critical examination, to have been the usual state-sponsored false flag stuff. False flag stuff, that's a highly technical term. There is no reason to think this one will be any different. The first question, as always, is, who gains? Or, in Latin I might add, cui bono? Because I asked the same question. Asking cui bono does not a false flag conspiracy theory lunatic make you. I mean, this guy, of course, his website article uses a picture of Pee-wee Herman from the old Pee-wee Herman show, holding up a French tricolor with the words "false flag" above it. You remember the old Pee-wee show, right? Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yeah.
Right. Never mind. You know, somebody get this guy up. Thorazine dart. The first answer, as always, is who gains, and the answer, as always, is authoritarian insiders, Zionists, militarists, Islamophobes, New World Order out of chaos freaks. Speaking of which, the order out of chaos thing is going into overdrive. On and on and on. But eventually he will betray himself because this. I think we can tentatively assume that this Friday the 13th massacre in Paris is just the latest in a long series of false flag spectacles, and if we let the perps get away with this one as they've gotten away with all the others, we can expect more of the same. Carol pointing out, he was in Paris? Paris, Texas, maybe. Not Paris, France. I don't know. I don't think it takes 9 hours to get from Paris, Texas to Chicago. Well, maybe. I don't know. If you're a moron, maybe it does. Oh, wait. If you're a Titanic intellect, maybe it does. You know, you turn your GPS upside down and start driving. Never mind. Yeah, 11 months after Charlie Hebdo, he just happens to be in France. Why am I so suspicious? Read the book. To be the Muslims did it stories of the big terror attacks starting with 9/11, you'd have to think of the ostensible Muslim perps as complete idiots, utterly incapable of strategic thinking, desperate to hand the Zionist neocons exactly the kind of PR they want. No, really. To believe you, what's Kevin Barrett, you'd have to write. And then he says, then again, maybe it's all just coincidence. Maybe this is an actual attack by angry Muslims. Maybe there is no state sponsorship. Maybe this time, for once, it actually isn't a false flag. And then, of course, there's a graphic to go at the bottom of it. And it just so happens to be the cover of The Economist magazine, which shows a big crowd of people. I see Vladimir Putin and Angela Merkel and Barack Obama and Narendra Modi from India. The Chinese premier is there. But down in the corner there are two little arrows sticking in the ground and an old Victorian era cut out paste over image of Alice from Alice. But the two arrows sticking in the ground say 11.5 and 11.3. The two numbered arrows from the controversial The World in 2015 Economist magazine cover of January 2015 unscramble into 11.13.15. 11.5, 11.3. Huh, oddly enough, it looks to me like they unscrambled into 11.5, 11.3, which sounds like somebody's really, really serious internet address. The woman in the portal near the arrows resembles the Mona Lisa painting, which is in Paris.
God almighty!
It resembles the Mona Lisa, and the Mona Lisa's in Paris, therefore... Only it's not the Mona Lisa. It is some other Renaissance portrait of a woman with her bust all bound up. And it is, and of course, whether that portrait's in Paris or not really doesn't matter, because the Mona Lisa is, and that painting is. Really? We couldn't just bother to go and find out who the... I mean, maybe that's the wife of... No. He was a monk. He wasn't allowed to be... Maybe that's the concubine of Jacques Desmoulins, and it would add even further fuel to the conspiratorial fire that attends Kevin Barrett's fetid, fervent, perfervid imaginings. Hmm. 35 minutes into the program, and I'm thinking, yeah, you know, maybe not. Nate, no, I mean, I've got my official brother Deacon Asa Swirly Straw up here. There might be a little tequila somewhere around the ranch here, and maybe it's time to get started. Maybe if I can get a half a liter down or so, it'll start to make sense. I mean, after all. On the controversial world in 2015, Economist magazine cover from January 2015, which I didn't know was controversial at all, and probably isn't except in the mind of Kevin Barrett and his friends and neighbors and readers. You know what else is on the cover? It's a panda standing in front of Angela Merkel. Mm-hmm. The panda is standing in front of Angela Merkel, but here's the problem. The panda may not be able, because from the neck down, it appears to be, I don't know, I'm not wearing my glasses, a tiny gorilla. See? Guerrilla warfare. Oh, wait, that's G-U-E-R... Can we just go back to the Sgt. Pepper's album cover instead, pretty please? So that's Merca. But I wonder, do they have to put up with this kind of foolishness in... I don't know. Oh, further interpretation. Hold on here. Wait a minute. Marty pointing out a panda standing in front of Angela Merkel. What's Red Sox third baseman Pablo Sandoval doing in Germany? A very good question indeed, Marty. What is he doing there? What does he have to do with the Illuminati? By the way, a little warning coming from Randy for Mac users. If you browse MikeMalloy.com to get into the Truth Seeker chat room button on a Mac, you will encounter a pop-up malware, drive-by download, or Mac Keeper, a notorious Mac Trojan horse. A drive-by download of Mac Keeper, a notorious Mac Trojan horse. I'm not savvy enough on Macs yet to know how to use a pop-up blocker over there, but I, whatever, yeah. Oh, breaking news. Well, howdy-do. Piyush, we hardly knew ye. Mm-hmm. Piyush Jindal has finally figured out that nobody wants him to be president. There he patiently stood, sat, drummed his fingers, twiddled his thumbs at a series of GOP pageants on the undercard at the kiddie table, and for some reason or another, no one paid much attention or was much interested at all. Piyush has left the building. He has quit. He has flown the coop. He is pining for the fjords. He has not joined the choir eternal. But no kidding, he's gone, he's done, he's out of the presidential race, and he's gonna go back home to Louisiana Stan and concentrate on being a little more white. Because that's the obvious takeaway. If only he'd been more white, the voters would have been more interested in him. No, I don't think so, because, I mean, after all, Mumbling Ben the Lion King is still doing quite well, isn't he? Sure. Mumbling Ben is doing just dandy. And, you know, he'll cut you. Or go after you with a hammer. He's taken a powder. Piyush has. No, Piyush's essential problem is that nobody, and that probably includes Piyush's mama and daddy, can stand Piyush. The people of Louisiana, he's got the worst gubernatorial ratings of practically any governor of Louisiana since we bought the place. Ugh. I mean, people like David Vitter better, and after all, that's a guy who lies about hiring hookers. Nice guy, that. Having decided to enter the president contest, Sparky tells me that he said the following. Going forward, I believe we have to be the party of growth, and we can never stop being the party that believes in opportunity. We cannot settle for the left's view of envy and division. We have to be the party that says everyone in this country, no matter the circumstances of their birth or who their parents are, can succeed in Merca. Yeehaw. Hot diggity. Hold me back. Listen, did he join the list of weirdos? What's his name up in Michigan? And Robert Bentley, the philandering, adultering hypocrite in Alabama, and Greg Abbott there in Texas Stan, and what's his name, Bryant in Mississippi Stan, and all the other, Asa Hutchinson in Arkansas, and all the various and sundry other right-wing weirdos. Did Piyush join up in with them and say, don't want none of them dark-skinned Middle Eastern Syrian refugees here in Louisiana? Did he? I don't remember seeing his name on the list, because that would have been awkward, wouldn't it? Has Nimrata Haley in South Carolina declared that none of those godless, heathen, Muslim, Syrian 3-year-olds can come to South Carolina? Has she done it? Has she joined it? Now, because that would be a little awkward, wouldn't it? Plenty for me, none for thee. He's got to do something, and I think Ben Carson's success shows that he's got to do something. Piyush is either going to have to be more white or more black. That sort of spilt coffee off. The right wingers are confused, and that's a lot of confusion when you use the Elizabethan form, where you put the accent over the accent grave over the E, and it becomes confused. Irish Dave asking, a tiny gorilla? Would that be a French dwarf? Kevin doesn't Kevin Barrett realize that Just Coincidence is abbreviated JC, which is the initials for, well, cheeses? Meanwhile, Piyush was all gin-dolled up with a nowhere to go. Oh, Irish Dave, you're so good at this stuff. And then this. I heard something about this earlier today, but I didn't flesh out the details of it. Irish Dave asks, what's up with the service union, SEIU, who've been advocating for the $15 an hour minimum wage, and endorsing cackling $12 an hour hilarity? Just saying.
Not saying, just saying.
Yeah, I couldn't sort that one out either, Dave. Sort of beats me. Like the Boogaloo. Which, by the way, I thought you might find this interesting. I got curious over the weekend and started asking myself adjusted for inflation questions. So I went back to 1960. To use the terminology from Robert A. Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land, I went back to 1960 and I'm only an egg. But no, in 1960, the minimum wage, adjusted for inflation, to today, the minimum wage would be, are you ready for this? It really does make that whole $15 an hour thing pale by comparison. The minimum wage in 1960 adjusted to today's dollars would have been $21 and or theirs adjusted to ours. If the 1960 minimum wage was applicable in 2015, the minimum wage would be $21.72 if it had kept pace with inflation. $21.72. And yet in the last GOP pageant, to a person, they all screamed, and particularly Trump, T-Rump was particularly delightful on this. People are just going to have to work harder to get into that special wealth category there where I am, where I started out with nothing in my pockets except a couple of $1 million loans from my pa, who had made his money discriminating against people and refusing to rent to the blacks. You know, there they are counting my money. I don't want anybody counting my money that hadn't got a little hat on his head. You might recall that Anthrax Coulter declared that Paris, the attacks on Paris, had just created President Trump. So, the minimum wage in 1960 dollars would be $21.72 an hour. In 1970, just 10 years later, it had already begun to degrade to the about $9, a little better than $9 an hour. From 1960 to 1970, the minimum wage lost more than half its value in inflation-adjusted dollars. From 1970 to 1980, it continued to lose value, but it didn't lose it at quite the same brisk rate. In 1980, as the world prepared to welcome Ronald Wilson Reagan, 666, into the White House, the inflation-adjusted minimum wage for 2015 had fallen to $8.46 per hour. That would have been the $3.35 an hour I earned as a pimply-faced little junior apprentice DJ. Another 10 years go by. 8 long years of
Well, Mommy, ketchup is a vegetable. We have declared the Soviet Union illegal. The missiles begin to fly in 5 minutes.
8 years of an Alzheimer's sufferer at the helm of power. 2 years of George H.W. Poppy bailout Bush. And by 1990, adjusted for inflation, the minimum wage is, wait a minute, $6.66 per hour. That's right, $6.66 per hour. In 30 years, the value of the minimum wage fell from $21.72 per hour to $6.66 per hour. Now, that becomes particularly interesting. Marty said, as a CWA member, what did SEIU do? Well, SEIU apparently has endorsed Dr. Senator Secretary Clinton for president. SEIU has been campaigning, agitating, militating, demanding a $15 an hour minimum wage. And they just endorsed a political candidate who says that, no, $15 an hour would be far too much for those spendthrift proles to be having in their pockets. Yeah, really. I had a feeling that $15 an hour was going to prove to be way too little, way too late. Yeah. So we've got that to chew on. We got a lot to chew on. Yeah, lots of Titanics. Definitely lots of Titanics. For pity's sakes. The ugliness continues. Last night, as we went through the evidence of the ugly spasms of anti-immigrant hatred gripping this country, we had the Pflugerville story, and we had the Florida story. You might recall in the days after September 11th, 2001, that, a Sikh man was dragged out of his cabin, beaten to death or something along the... I remember a Sikh being killed because he had a turban and a beard. Well, Uber is troubling. Apparently, it's the business model of the future, if you ask Carly Fiorina and most of the other weirdos of the clown arc. Uber's a way for you to take your car and put your fuel in it and your time in it, and pay Uber for the right to call yourself an Uber driver and keep a pittance of the proceeds. What a country. Well, there's an Uber driver in North Carolina named Samson Woldemichael. 8 years ago, he came to the United States quite legally, thank you very much. From Ethiopia. And early on Sunday morning, which would be late Saturday night, he picked up a passenger at a Charlotte bar who was probably, apparently, since he was calling Uber, probably too intoxicated to operate a motor vehicle. So we'll give him points for having the sense not to get on the road loaded. But he picks the guy up at the bar, and he's driving him to his home, which is about 10 miles away. And once they got to the guy's home, well, he starts getting hateful. Anybody want to guess this guy's white? Became belligerent, as the news story puts it. And threatened to shoot Samson Woldemichael in the face. Did I mention he came from Ethiopia? Yes. And no, he's not one of the famous lost white Ethiopians either. No. He threatened to shoot Samson Woldemichael in the face. He threatened to strangle Samson Woldemichael and began screaming anti-Muslim epithets and dirty words at Samson Woldemichael from, did I mention, Ethiopia. Interviewed, Samson Woldemichael said, he asked me if I was a Muslim, and I said I was not a Muslim. I was driving, and he hit me while I was driving. I told him in the first place I was not a Muslim. It's not right to generalize people and do that. Meanwhile, Samson Woldemichael confirmed that actually, yes, he's a Christian. He didn't know why the man assumed he was Muslim. Really, Mr. Woldemichael? I'll bet Samson Woldemichael don't talk nothing like this. No. Don't talk even a little bitty bit like this here. And seeing as he wasn't talking like this here, but in fact probably had some version of the refined British-style English that is taught over that away. The guy just naturally assumed anybody that didn't talk like that, and I mean, you ain't talking like one of our regular black folks around here. You must be a Muslim. So after the guy threatens to kill him and shoot him in the face and strangle him, he wouldn't get out of the car. And instead, Samson Woldemichael drove around the block a few times, and eventually the irate white guy hit him hard enough in the forehead to nearly knock him out, and then kept hitting him in the head. Eventually, Samson Woldemichael pulled up in his, it just came to a stop, and began honking the horn for all he was worth. At which point in time, the white guy, come on, it was a white guy, jumped out of the car and continued to threaten to shoot Samson Woldemichael. He was saying he would shoot me, and he's acting like he's hiding his hand in his back, so he was acting like he was armed. Not being a complete idiot and waiting to find out, Samson Woldemichael applied his foot to the accelerator pedal, immediately left, and started dialing 911 for all he was worth. Here's the fun part in the news story. You can see this over at Raw Story. So far, no arrests have been made. WBTV-TV had the report. We'll forego the audio. So far, no arrests have been made because looking for an angry white guy screaming anti-Muslim epithets in a place like that, that's like looking for a needle in a needle stack. I mean, if it was at the Charlotte football stadium.
This is your public address announcer. Would all of the white guys who hate Muslims please report to the customer service desk?
The stadium would empty. Bless his heart, Samson Woldemichael said he wished that some Americans, I think we could use the word most, Mr. Woldemichael, weren't so afraid of immigrants like himself. In particular, he said, there are people who are not originally from here, but who are really Americans in their hearts. They love the system, they love the country, and they want to protect the system here, and they want to raise their kids peacefully with the existing system. They believe in America, so it's better to work with them than generalizing them and attacking them. I couldn't agree more, Mr. Woldemichael. Why in God's name are you raising your family in North Carolina? I'd ask him the same thing if he was in West Virginia. Wait a minute. Wait, breaking news. Who knew that Mel Gibson was at a bar in Charlotte, North Carolina on late Saturday night? Oh, no, Mel gets mad at the Jews.
I'm telling you, it was the Jews. They ruined me and they ruined Hollywood. Freedom! Somebody paint my face blue.
Have you seen the Charlie Hebdo cartoon coming out of Paris? They don't quit. They're afraid of nothing. The caption to a cartoon showing a guy gushing liquids from out of his abdomen and drinking from a glass and holding a fizzing bottle says, "They have weapons. Screw them.
We have champagne."
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Southerners, well, we've got one coming out of the break. You're gonna love this one. This is all kinds of good fun. It also happens to be Tuesday, Titanic Tuesday, as previously and frequently noted. And we have the Green News Report upcoming with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. I'm looking forward to that. I know you are as well. And, of course, the phone lines are open. You can jump in at any time you may desire. You know the numbers, right? Line 1 is 304-574-8178. Line 2 is the stress line. Named after the inimitable, irrepressible Bill, Mr. Stress Miller, 304-663-4676, 304-663-HORN. And, of course, Skype to Skype is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid Horn. All of them work equally well, and you can involve yourself in the program as you wish. We will take a little break. Your calls, further filibobstering, who knows? Yeah, all manner of fun, and yeah, we'll just have a blast. This is listener-supported conversation radio. Like I said, Green News Report on the way. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's Tuesday, November 17, 2015.
All of us believe climate change is real.
Climate and energy get short shrift in the second Democratic presidential debate.
In the previous debate, you said the greatest threat to national security was climate change. Do you still believe that?
Yes, U.S. media, climate change remains a national security risk. International climate talks will go forward despite Paris terror attacks. Plus,
the reward was not worth the risk.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo vetoes major natural gas facility.
All of that natural gas and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
They said the rising sea levels would put parts of Florida underwater. We said only parts.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, a source of mine who works with the military in Europe, says that they have never seen such high security in place as they're seeing now in Paris in advance of the UN climate talks. They say that even contractors are being highly vetted like never before.
Yes, intensified security measures are now in place in Paris in advance of the International Climate Treaty Conference. UN officials and French government officials announced that the conference will go forward as scheduled in 2 weeks, but marches, concerts, rallies, and other outside events are likely to be canceled. More than 150 world leaders will attend the opening of the conference, including President Barack Obama and the leaders of Russia, China, India, and the European Union. The two-week conference is focused on completing a new comprehensive international agreement for all nations to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that cause dangerous climate change. Meanwhile, at the second 2016 Democratic presidential debate hosted by CBS News on a Saturday night in Des Moines, Iowa, moderators chose to ask no direct questions about climate change or energy policy, despite the importance of both, except for one mention. John Dickerson of Face the Nation did offer Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders a chance to do over his previous remarks linking climate change to national security and terrorism.
In the previous debate, you said the greatest threat to national security was climate change. Do you still believe that?
Absolutely. In fact, climate change is directly related to the growth of terrorism. And if we do not get our act together and listen to what the scientists say, you're going to see countries all over the world. This is what the CIA says. They're going to be struggling over limited amounts of water, limited amounts of land to grow their crops. And you're going to see all kinds of international conflict.
On Sunday's Face the Nation, Dickerson then asked Sanders to explain further how drought in Syria gave rise to terrorist organizations like ISIS.
When you have drought, when people can't grow their crops, they're going to migrate into cities. And when people migrate into cities and they don't have jobs, there's going to be a lot more instability, a lot more unemployment. So where you have discontent, where you have instability, that's where problems arise. And certainly, without a doubt, climate change will lead to that.
We have been covering this issue for well over a year at this point, since the rise of ISIS. The fact that so many in the media and the public, and certainly in the Republican Party, don't understand the connection is, frankly, a national shame.
In fact, over a decade of CIA and Defense Department research finds that climate change impacts are a threat multiplier
Christmas
that aggravates unrest in volatile regions in ways that help fuel terrorism.
Brand.
So, to wrap up this Democratic debate, CBS did not ask any questions about energy policy or about the United Nations International Climate Agreement, which the next president will carry out. All three of the Democratic candidates have significant specific policies for energy and climate change, but you wouldn't know that if you watched any of the debates so far. Finally, buried by the news of the Paris attacks, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on Friday vetoed a major proposed liquefied natural gas port facility in Long Island Sound in favor of an offshore wind farm proposed for the same location. But he also cited security concerns.
We have terrorist groups that are springing up more and more who look for targets of opportunity where there's a potential to do a significant amount of damage.
Cuomo also pointed to the billions of dollars in damage to New York's infrastructure that was caused by Superstorm Sandy, to conclude that the project was not worth the risk.
By the way, I don't believe that that is the last time we're going to deal with something like that. Climate change is real. Extreme weather is real.
This is actually a very big deal. We've seen just within the past 2 weeks the president turning down the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada. Now Governor Cuomo turning down this natural gas pipeline in New York. We may be turning a page when it comes to fossil fuels in this country. These are big stories. Pay attention. For much more on all of the stories we covered today and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
There I go, turn the page.
Sixteen minutes past the hour on this Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, and, 17 minutes. And, I want to send out some big thanks because we have reached the halfway point on Chris's challenge. Chris's challenge to help us not be in quite such an ungodly hole after next week. And that means that $250 of the $500 challenge she put on the table has been met, and hopefully that will just continue unabated. Thank you to Bob in Texas, and thank you to Brother Deacon Asa for your efforts in that regard. Let's see. Little note. And Asa said, by way of a message, congrats on filling in for Malloy, Brother Bob. Those are some big shoes to fill, and if anyone can do it, I know it's you. I hope I can. I'm wildly honored to even get the chance, and I'm looking forward to it, and I'm also nervous as a wax cat in a candle factory about it. Mm-hmm. And we're tinkering with the audio a little bit along the way as well. And by the way, a note coming from Philip in Maryland. Philip, who is going to have a problem with Ron and Raleigh because he has violated Ron and Raleigh's copyright, and there's intellectual property involved, dadgummit. And, here in Merco, we don't tolerate that. I say that because the subject line of Philip's note is Bob, Bob, Bob. Now, we all know that Ron and Raleigh owns Bob, 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 so you're going to have to negotiate that as a separate side deal, okay, Philip? Please, Phillips writes, please stop criticizing Ben Carson. By running for president, he has performed a noble act to end intellectual elitism and promote equality in this nation. I'm already smirking. After all, no longer do I have to inform my children that I don't know something and quip, after all, I'm not a brain surgeon. Now I'm waiting for a politically dense, ignorant, obtuse rocket scientist to declare for the presidency. Thanks, Ben. I am no longer intellectually intimidated by allegedly brilliant surgeons because of your candidacy. Equally important, I have to admit that I feel sorry for Ben because he hasn't figured out the dirty little secret that his fellow Republicans won't reveal. They may give lip service to supporting him, but ain't no way in hell they're going to have two black presidents in a row inhabiting their White House when they're simultaneously attacking women's rights to birth control and abortions in a bizarre attempt to increase white demographics. Yeah, see, when you put it that way, Philip, we're going to... okay. Because that way we'll wind up with more... but what about the... my head hurts. Philip continues, so it goes in these disunited states. I'm so happy not to be a Christian right now because I don't have to fear Middle Eastern immigrants fleeing oppression and settling in my neighborhood. I figure if my neighbors can tolerate an Irish Yankee agnostic among their midst, then they just may agree with me. In fact, I'm willing to broker a deal. I'll accept 4 Syrian refugees for every reactionary Republican we deport. To where? Why, Russia, of course, because that country has a strong white leader whom they admire for making quick decisions and not thinking beyond the perimeters of his KGB training. Trump? Putin? It's so hard to discern between fascists these days. Back to the main point of this meandering paragraph. Apparently, no one has apprised Huckleberry Mike that and his allegedly religious ilk and fellow Republicans but one, the failed corporate executive, that they believe in the deity of the son of Middle Eastern refugees from a despotic regime. I know. The cognitive dissonance is like a daggum one kilohertz tone. It's just all and nothing really gets over it, does it? Wait a minute, I better not be doing my tone impressions anymore. You know, I could probably ruin automation all over the country just doing that. I'm playing. It's going to be a completely different thing. Attacking Ethiopians, you say? Philip asks. Why, yes, I did. A country with one of the oldest Christian churches in the world? Why, yes, it is. As we say on Fox, let's not let facts interfere with our beliefs. I'm thinking it's time to start drinking again, but instead I'm donating from my government pension to elect Democratic candidates and a socialist president, and of course to the Horn Monthly and more when possible. Damn, I miss Mr. Stress's wry and informed observations lately. I do. Be well. Signed, Philip. Oh, Philip, I get such joy from your notes. Because you do that hoodoo that you do so well. Lion King Ben Carson, equality superstar. Exactly. Now, see, I told you, Philip. I told you. Dadgummit, I told you. Now we got a problem. Ron and Raleigh, subject line, gimmick infringement. Ron says, I don't have much, but I do have Bob. Philip, you have a one-time pass. Please do not abuse the privilege. Well, wasn't that just downright decent? He's not going to send out his horde of pettifogging lawyers after you, Philip. I think we have the beginnings here of a friendship, don't you? But, okay, so there's this. The King of Jordan...
Christmas is coming.
Oh, stop it! Christmas is coming. Really, I need to be reminded? I'm trying to forget. Where... I hate auto-run audio. I do. Whoever invented it needs to be, made to try to do a broadcast and have it just pop up intermittently. But it pops up and then it goes away, so you never know where it came. It's gone. No, one of our partners in peace over in the Middle East, which is actually Western Asia, but we had to come up with a different name besides Middle East, because back when we started calling it the Middle East, if we'd called it Western Asia, a lot of people in this country would have thought we meant, you know, Thailand, Mecca, greatest country in the world on earth now, today, forever, indivisible, under God, amen! I'm talking about the Jordanians, and, you know, when you compare somebody like, say, King Abdullah of Jordan with, say, Bashar Assad of Syria, Abdullah comes out being the guy that you wouldn't mind living next door to. King Abdullah being, of course, related to, he's the son of King Hussein, who is a part of the Hashemite family that got screwed in favor of the in favor of the royal house of Ibn Saud in Saudi Arabia. Transjordan, the British having that part of the mandate after the Sykes-Picot map drawing competition. Palestine went to Britain, and Britain, right, Transjordan is what it was referred to, yes. And so, according to Agence France-Presse, King Abdullah II of Jordan is trying to impress upon the world that ISIS, ISIL, Daesh are, well, he described them as savage outlaws of religion. Now, you want a band name? Oh. I bet if the drive-by truckers hadn't already been busy being the drive-by truckers, they'd probably stop right now and become the savage outlaws of religion. Savage! Oh, yes. But no, he said they're savage outlaws of religion. And he said some pretty scary stuff. Abdullah II said, "We are facing a third world war against humanity, and this is what brings us all together." Yeah, frankly, I'd rather be brought together by nicer things, you know, good, nice flaming rum punch. Something, but never, no, I don't think we get that. He said, "This is a war, as I've said repeatedly, within Islam. Groups like ISIS expose themselves daily as savage outlaws of religion, devoid of humanity, respecting no laws and no boundaries." Okay. So therefore, he continued, "We must act fast and holistically to tackle and respond to the interconnected threats, whether it is in this region, Africa, Asia, or in Europe." Why didn't he say nothing about Merca? Does he not love Merca? But he, by the way, while we are quibbling about over whether to bring 10,000 refugee, many of them children, from Syria into the United States, and while tens of thousands have fled northward into Europe, France, Germany. Mm-hmm. Now, go look on the map if you feel like you need to. But insofar as this is a liberal audience, a progressive audience, otherwise known as an intelligent audience, you know, I mean, as you could take the whole of Jordan and set it like little tiny puzzle pieces, probably 10 or 20 of them, inside a couple of French provinces or German states. Get this. Jordan has taken in 1,400,000 Syrians desperate to get out of Syria. They've been taking them in since 2011. That's Jordan's number. The UN High Commission for Refugees says the figure is more like 600,000. They're probably both right. Maybe they took in 1.4 million and 800,000 have managed to keep moving onward elsewhere. It is worth remembering, as Agence France-Presse notes, 250,000 people a good-sized town in anywhere USA, the entire population thereof, have died. They're just dead. They're not here. They're not being sitting up mud anymore on this little blue-green time machine hurtling through the universe. And that really is a pity, because I think you only get to do it once. A real shame. You get to, the mud gets to sit up and look around and try to figure things out and maybe have a little fun, and then it's over, and that's 250,000 people whose lives were probably never fun at all, ever, any time. King Abdullah continued and said, fighting extremism is our fight as Muslims against those who aim to turn our societies and future generations towards fanaticism and extremism. Sounds like he's saying some stuff that maybe all those clowns on the Republican clown art can get down with.
No.
Of course not. But it's that World War III business that sort of scares the bejesus out of me. You? Last time we tried the World War thing, well, both times we've tried the World War thing, it's worked out to a rather bloody conclusion, a rather deadly conclusion. How many in World War I? How many in the Second World War? Civilians and soldiers combined? Yeah, I know. Not encouraging. Let's don't do that again. Let's don't and say we didn't. So, does this really, if you look back in history, particularly at the origins of the Great War, the war to make the world safe for democracy, if you look at the origins there, you know, the Gavrilo Princip, Archduke Franz Joseph, Franz Ferdinand, can't remember, Franz, we'll just call him Franz. And you consider in that little moment of murder, and that was just one guy, one pistol. And there's somebody else with a bomb too, wasn't there? And that got millions dead. Now, granted, nobody who was massacred in Paris last Friday had the dubious distinction of being sublimely and serenely royal. But does this feel to you World War III-ish? Because ever since the close of the Second World War and the development of nuclear weapons, we've always sort of had the assumption that World War III would involve mushroom clouds, because that's how we ended World War II. And being as how we were the ones who used the nuclear devices at the end of World War II, well, yeah. But does this have the power to become a World War III situation? If it does, how does it? Does it happen in the skies over Syria, when some Russian jet jockey takes a pot shot at an American jet jockey, or perhaps, because it would be, you know, the last thing in the world you wanted to consider, perhaps some Russian jet jockey takes a pot shot at a member of the Luftwaffe. We remember how that worked out. Little powder keg moments. Probably better not be doing that anymore either. So many things to relearn. It's frightening, and it's existentially frightening. Because there's something about the idea of a World War III that even though King Abdullah didn't mention North America, or the Americas generally, South America either for that matter, even though he didn't mention us, you get a sense that maybe it wouldn't pass us by this time, at least in terms of physical locations. But still, and this is the part where I get a little bit baffled. I mean, not Kevin Barrett baffled or anything, but a little bit baffled. How does that play out? And is it... Is it what we fear it is? I mean, this is some real existential creepiness. Because you get the sense that there are those out there, and you know, who knows, maybe some of them are wearing uniforms. Some people thinking, really? World War III? That would be cool. We got all kinds of stuff we can make, we can blow stuff up with. Cool. You know, I think about what triggered the First World War, and I wonder, you know, is there somebody inside that general region that would set the armies to marching again? Because there in that region of Western Asia, according to numbers I ran across the other day, yeah, there are the various armies there have about 5 million soldiers, all told. That's enough to get a good slaughter started, isn't it? But one place we know it's not going to be fought. Oh no. And we have a real military genius kind of authority to help us along in that regard. And you kind of hope the ISIS jerks weren't paying attention. Of course, you may recall that Tony Norman, yes, Mother Bates, Perkins, of the Family Research Council, he's president, you know, of the Family Research Council. They spend a lot of time worrying about the little fetuses. Yes, the Family Research Council. And Tony Perkins, they got a little radio program. They call it Washington Watch. And Tony Norman, yes, Mother Bates Perkins. Well, he thinks we're probably gonna get hit by the ISIS here in the new United States of Merca. Take the reverb part as read. But even so, some of Merca is still going to be safe from the ISIS. Oh, hockey puck. The hockey puck moment. Really. You're going, yes. Mm-hmm. You may want the hockey puck for the remainder of the hour.
There have been estimates of hundreds of people that could be classified as kind of foreign fighters ranging around America on our soil. I don't know what the numbers are. I just know that with our loose border and the capacity to move in and out on passports and the fact that our government has not revoked any passports that I know about right now, that it's plausible to believe that we could potentially have the same thing brewing in our country that obviously demonstrated and manifested itself on Friday in France.
I agree with you. I do think that it's less likely to happen in the South, where more of the citizens are armed. I'm serious.
I'm not laughing to make a joke out of it. I'm just telling you, as a concealed carry permit guy myself, and as somebody that represents a great district in the 3rd District of Arkansas, where there's a lot of folks like us, it's probably less likely that it would happen there. Although, if you want to make a statement, there are many targets in the South that that go right to the heart of who we are as Americans.
That's true, but we know how to defend ourselves.
We certainly do, and we always will.
You got that? Now, these right-wing idiots are out there tweaking the nose of ISIS. Hey, you know what? You know what? Hey, y'all might try to attack America. Y'all might try to attack one of them sissy liberal states like your Massachusetts or your California. Yeah, sure, you might do that. Yeah. Hey, you might. I mean, look. I mean, you're Al Qaeda. They didn't come after a good God fearing, upstanding, Bible believing place like Elks, North Tennessee. No, sir. They went after the sissy liberals up there in New York City. Well, they won't come after us here in the South. Because here in the South, our citizens is armed. And we knows how to defend ourselves. And we've been, that's how come it was that when we looked out there at the Charleston Harbor, and them boys from them little cadets from the Citadel come down out of the harbor side, and there stood Pierre Gustave Toutant Beauregard, and he had him some cannons handy, and they said, "Look at them Yankees out there in the harbor a threatening of us. I mean, they got guns that point out to sea, but that don't mean they ain't a threatening us." And Pierre Gustave Toutant Beauregard, he said, "Far!" And they took to foreign, cause them Southerners, they know how to defend theyselves. Maybe Tony Norman, yes, Mother Bates Perkins, could get Dim Leader to come on his program and reprise his most famous act and say, "Bring it on." Bring him on, as Roger in Oregon points out, that would be bring him on too. So I don't care. I don't care what that unchristian heathen King Abdullah II says. Them ISIS, they might attack a whole world. But you know what? They don't want nothing to do with Bubba Joe Nose Knuckle. No, they don't. They don't want nothing to do with Bubba Joe, because he knows how to use a weapon. And he'll shoot him some ISIS. Now, mind you, it might actually not be ISIS. It might just be a Syrian refugee family what was trying to get away from ISIS. But, you know, you can't be too careful when it comes to your Arab killing and to your defending of your home native soil. Honest to Jesus. I agree with you. I do think it's less likely to happen in the South, where more of the citizens are armed. I'm serious. Now wait just a minute. there are something on the order of 350 million of us here in Merca. And for the 350 million of us, there are something on the order of 300 million guns. Now, granted, there was that news story a couple of weeks ago where the God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered Christian Merkin patriot in South Carolina got himself arrested because, well, he might have been all of them things, but he was also a criminal. Maybe a little on the not screwed down side of things. But he got himself arrested with 7,000 guns in his hoose. But that's not everybody in the South. I mean, there are people who live in the South who don't have any guns. I know, difficult to believe. But it is the absolute truth. But Tony, Norman, yes, Mother Bates, Perkins, and his buddy there representing Steve Womack from Arkanstan. Well, they're just fantasizing about the time that great-great-grandpappy put on the butternut and wrapped some rags about their feet and marched off to defend the right of white people to own black people against the intruders from the north. Yankees. Wolverines! Right? Because, see, representing Steve Womack, pig licking of Arkanstan, well, he's a patriot. Mm-hmm. He comes from, and I'm sure Haley knows who Steve Womack is. You know, these down south, there's some good Womacks and some not so good Womacks. This would be your not so good Womack. Yeah, Travis Womack. He's one of your good Womacks. Look him up. From his very own website, where it says, "Lead by example, lead from the front." On Tuesday, January 6, 2015, representing Steve Womack, R3, along with representing John Duncan, 10-2, Robert Pittenger, North NC9, and Bruce Westerman, R4, introduced HR 178. Let's see, that's a 3 and a 2. That's 5 and 9. That's 14 and 4. That's 18 and 196. I can still cipher. Introduced HR 178, the Terrorist Denaturalization and Passport Revocation Act, to address the dangerous and unique threat to our homeland posed by U.S. citizens actively joining the ranks of terrorist organizations such as your Natural Organization for Women's, your Sierra Club, or your ISIS. No, I added terrorist organizations, period. Damn liberal. Specifically, the Terrorist Denaturalization and Passport Revocation Act. You know, I tried drinking some denaturalized alcohol one time, about went blind. The Terrorist Denaturalization and Passport Revocation Act amends, everybody say amends, amends, amends the Immigration and Nationality Act by including certain acts of allegiance to terrorist organizations like the Democrat Party. Well, I added that part too. As a renunciation of U.S. citizenship, which serves as grounds for denaturalization, the bill also amends the Passport Act to provide increased mechanisms for the U.S. State Department and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security when it comes to the revocation of passports of U.S. citizens engaging in terrorist activities like protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. No, I added that part too. Upon introduction, Congressman Womack released the below statement. Not the following statement? No, it's the below statement. Below. 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 No, the below statement. When an American turns against their country by willfully traveling overseas to join forces with terrorists, a revocation of citizenship and the privileges it affords them is not only warranted but necessary to ensure that these here citizens are not able to freely re-enter the U.S. to carry out attacks on our homeland. Nothing in there about what happens to American citizens who do things like flying treason flags and talking about that one in our White House and taking arms up against and levying war against the United States of America like a certain young man did, arguably. I mean, that's what he said he was doing. I mean, that's all we can go by is his own statement. You know, Dylann Roof said he was trying to start a race war. Well, that would have been, he wasn't trying to start a race war in Burundi. He's trying to start a race war here. That would mean that he was levying war against the United States of America. And yet, up until the moment at which South Carolina probably winds up horizontally crucifying Dylann Roof, because that's how we do it, you know, horizontal crucifixion. Up until that moment, you know what Dylann Roof is going to be the whole blessed time? A new United States citizen of the greatest country in the world on earth now, today, forever, under God, indivisible, amens. Amens. Not that I want a great spasm going across the country of people getting de-citizenship, because I figure I'll be an undocumented immigrant before you can say mountaintop removal. Gerald pointing out, well, you see, there's that whole due process thingy in the Constitution that messes up revoking people's citizenship. We don't need no stinking due process. We got upstanding, Bible-believing, God-fearing, Christ-centered, representing Steve Womack from the 3rd District of Arkansas to protect our due process rights. Hey, by the way, glad to see Ron in the Unfrozen North back involved in the conversation. Ron says, you know, I'm listening for the first time in a few days, because Ron went south from unfrozen Canada down to Merca. Ron says, because we have not sealed our borders like France. I'm listening for the first time in a few days. I didn't dare fire it up while I was at my mom's place because she's 86 and has a very weak ticker. Kelly and I would have lost her 10 minutes into the show. Another 750-mile trip in the books today. I'm counting on Reverend Craig to help me get some feeling back in my ass. And for next week, that'll be posterior or perhaps hindquarters. Got to clean it up a little bit, people. Well, welcome back home. I'm glad you've survived your visit to the American Shooting Gallery and got safely back to civilization, Ron. Indeed, indeed. But you ISIS sissies with your Toyota pickup trucks, y'all just come on, try to come on down south. You got AK-47s. Phooey. Heck,
We got dozens of them. We only shoot them when we're done shooting our grenade launchers. I mean, you know what? I'll bet people go to the extent that there's anywhere left in Syria where anything remains of ordinary, normal, day-to-day civil society. You know what I'll bet? I'll bet that in the midst of all the chaos that has claimed 250,000 lives and created a million daggum refugees, you know what I'll bet? I'll bet there's all kinds of people every day that get up and walk out into the blasted, blown-away streets and go walking down to the market, you know, to get a tomato, some onions, an eggplant, who knows, some bread, yeah, bread, whatever, tea, coffee, if they've still got all that. And you know what? I bet a bunch of them aren't carrying guns. The same cannot be said of folks here in Merca. Oh no. Oh no. Because by God, especially down here in the South, we's ready for ISIS. I mean, if your ISIS fighter is on the way to his jihad there to kill him off some infidels and has to stop off at the Wally World for a jug of milk and a loaf of bread, we gonna be waiting for him. We gonna be laying for him. We'll see him coming through the door there into Action Alley, and we will just blow him away. Because you know that's why we go to Walmart with our 8-inch barrel, Dirty Harry, Smith and Wesson 44 Magnum, strapped one to each leg, because you never know when ISIS is going to want a loaf of milk and a jug of bread. You don't know. That's the thing. They could be anywhere. They are already here. They're just a waiting. And you don't know who they are. They might be masquerading at your Mexican restaurant, and maybe your Chinese restaurant. They're like that. One minute they're asking you, do you want the number F luncheon special, and the next thing you know, they've stripped off their "Hello, my name is Miguel" badge, and they're hollering "Allahu Akbar," and they got an AK-47 instead of that pitcher of margaritas that was froze up, and you didn't want the salt that you ordered. We ain't got no idea of the amount of danger we are in right here in Merca. No idea at all. I wish that wasn't so easy. Honest, Jesus, I do. But that's practically any street corner below the Mason-Dixie line, and some street corners north of it. And it is, in a word, frightening. But in the final analysis, and this is not the final analysis because we've got another hour of the program to go, but, and I do not wish to in any wise diminish the horrors that have been perpetrated in places like Paris, Beirut, in Kenya, and God knows on any day of any week in anywhere, Syria, and all over Iraq, or the heartbreak of people who were trying to simply have a vacation away from
Russia. Egypt is a prime tourist destination for Russians. And who wouldn't like to see the pyramids? Those giant grain silos. I got to calculate, and you know, I think you could get about a bag of Pillsbury gold medal flour if you were using whole grain. I think you could get about maybe a 50 pound toe sack of flour into the Jesus, stupid. Those poor people blown up in midair. And so what I'm about to say, I don't mean to diminish the horror and the grief and the anguish and the agony by any stretch of the imagination. September 11th, we had 3,000 people killed. We had that many killed in the Normandy invasion, right? 129 here, 168 there, and if I seem callous, I do not intend to be. We are shocked because we are generationally removed from definitions of real horror. Serious, unending, ceaseless, remorseless horror. And so at least at this point in time, what's going on with a group of about 30,000 malcontent thugs seems an awfully long way from anything that went on in the First or Second World Wars. That's not to say that the proper spark applied to the proper tender cannot immediately flash up into a huge conflagration. But you would think, and by the way, we're still trying to maintain a free broadcast. You would think to hear the right-wingers talk about it that what happened in Paris was the equivalent of the rape of Nanking. Hell! If one has a working knowledge of history, what happened in Paris on the 13th wasn't even... It even paled by comparison to what the Parisian nobility did to ordinary workaday Parisians in the 14th century in the uprising of the Jacquerie. The French nobility slaughtered the bejesus out of its own people. You know, I mean, if you flash that forward into the 21st century, you'd have some little nitwit from Texas saying, that Charles is a brutal dictator who kills his own people. I guess all I'm asking for is a little perspective. If only because I think the same might prove beneficial somewhere along the way. It's about 5 minutes past the hour, and this is Conversation Radio, I'll remind you. If you'd like to engage in the conversation, the numbers are 304-574-8178. We'll call that line one. We'll call line two the stress line, 304-663-4676. We'll call the Skype line, and that's Skype to Skype from anywhere on the planet if you'd like to engage. And that is Bob Kincaid Horn. If you've never sent me a contact request, do it lickety-split and lickety-split. I will have approved it, and bang, we'll be talking. Odoki? and by the way, if you would like to get a good handle on the France that I just described and the slaughter of the Jacquerie and the Jacquerie, it's another way of saying Joe Sixpack, ordinary Parisians. Every now and then I go back and I reread the same woman who wrote The Guns of August wrote a magnificent book about about 14th century France called A Distant Mirror. Barbara Tuchman, Tuchman. And I guess I'm just a nerd that way. I think that having a handle on history makes it far more possible, more likely to understand the world in which we presently live. Barbara Tuchman called her book on 14th century France A Distant Mirror because it looked to her, after she had gone through the research to write The Guns of August about the origins of World War I, or the beginning days of World War I, it looked as though the 14th century was holding up a mirror at a great distance to the 20th century. See, horrible, horrible things happened in Europe after those well-meaning but misguided and largely unemployed plunderers and pillagers of the Crusades came home. Part of the reason that that England was able to go over and knock the snot out of France periodically was because France was in a near constant state of chaos. It was not the France we understand to be France now. I mean, there was the Aragon. Aquitaine, Aragon, Spain, but the Aquitaine was what I was thinking about. Burgundy, all little separate sort of fiefdoms and petty kingdoms. And when the Crusaders returned, we might say they had PTSD, perhaps, but once you get used to crusading and being able to kill anything that moves with impunity and have the Pope at Rome say, "Blessed art thou," yeah, you get it, yeah, mulligan! For Muslim slaughtering. You realize that pillaging and plundering can be profitable, and so France was absolutely tormented through the better part of a century by roving gangs of thugs who were headed by people just generically referred to as captains. And peasantry that was absolutely without protection. And the French killed a lot more of their own than thus far, or on their best day, or if they keep this up for a very long time, Muslim malcontents will be able to kill. I am not by any wise comparing the two or suggesting one is right and one is wrong. They are both equally wrong. But a little bit of perspective goes an awfully long damn way. So if you want to, light up the phones. Share your thoughts. Engage in conversation. I welcome it. And thanks, Greg, from the moderator and administrator of the Malloy chat room. Thanks, Greg, for signing up for a subscription. It is much appreciated. moving our way toward the first 100 of the formidable 400. That's two people now that Tony and Chico will cover, or will double their first month's subscription contribution. Thanks, Tony. Challenge still on the table, $250 to go. Challenge courtesy of Chris in Germany. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Asa. Thank you, Bob. Hopefully, 25 at 10, 10 at 25, however we want to do it, you'll get some company. And there's company. $225 to go now. Thanks, Philip. Thanks a bunch. We'll take a break and come back. I'm Bob. And what we have there is courtesy of the great disco DJ Glenn Rivera, who I think is still out in San Diego way. We have the disco version of the classic Edith Piaf ballade, La Vie en Rose. And I was just I was just communicating with Sister Carol Baker, and I had to explain that that's a disco version of La Vie en Rose. And the long intro is there because disco songs had to have long intros to give people a chance to hear it and go, "Oh, it's that," and get all the way back from where they were snorting coke in the restrooms to the dance floor. That's why that. Yeah. But no, that goes back to the heady days of back when America did not have a five nights a week LGBT radio program. Peter Godbold created the very first one, and it was here on the Horn. It was called Strictly Confidential, and that goes back. Glenn Rivera provided tons of magnificent music, and Peter himself, going back to his days in his wild days in Portland, Oregon, was in fact a DJ in his own right. A couple of notes, a couple coming from Roger in Oregon. Roger observes, there's virtually no limit, talking about the Tony Norman. Yes, Mother Bates Perkins.
I don't think MISIS are going to come down south here. We defend ourselves. We got some guns.
Roger says, there's virtually no limit to how brave some are in standing up to imaginary dangers. Indeed, indeed. And seriously, thank you. Thank you, Philip, and thank you, Thomas. We are now down to only $200 to go on Chris's challenge to help fill in the gaps for next week when we won't be doing any fundraising, and we'll dig ourselves a hole intentionally, mind you, but still. Thank you very kindly. That's 200 more to go. 10 at 20, 20 at 10, maybe 8 new subscribers at $10 a piece to fill out Tony and Chico's $100 contribution challenge. And remember, everybody gets a bumper sticker. Absolutely. And some get more than one, depending on how you subscribe and how much you subscribe for. And if you do 20 a month, you get both. Note coming from Philip. And I'm going to go to the Skype line here in a moment here. Line one, actually. Philip writes, subject line, "Damn it, Ron. Ron, I'm a red-blooded, peace-loving American, and you can't make future threats against me if I use Bob to the third power, because if you do, then I'm just going to have to bomb you into submission and perhaps prematurely declare victory before you effect reprisal against me. The first part of that strategy has worked wonderfully well for our Middle Eastern policy, and I'm sticking with it. Just look how successfully it's worked in Syria, Iraq, Libya, and Afghanistan. Like Hillary says, there's democracy in Libya right now. People there don't have to choose between only two parties. Hell, they've been able to vote for one of two governments. How's that for success, huh? Folks in Iraq have choices now, too. They get to flee ethnic and religious strife caused by the legitimate government, and as a bonus, flee the Islamic State that has been formed in large part by former Iraqi military, whom Paul Bremer expelled from the military, depriving them of economic and social status. We Americans believe so strongly in plurality that we've been willing to back several Syrian rebel groups against Assad at the expense of noticing the ISIL elephant in the room until recently. And Afghanistan? I don't even need to mention how many folks were able to vote in the last election for the president for Kabul. Another success story after our initial success in supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. What could possibly go wrong with supporting extremist Islamist militias willing to become martyrs to fight against the Ruskies and pursue their own homegrown corrupt poppy exporting rule? Why, it's helped make Afghanistan the thriving democracy it is today." Oh, wait. You got to understand, Ron and Bob, that we always want to peacefully support change in the Arab world by opposing folks like Gaddafi so Libyans can have the democratic freedom to wage a civil war and choose with which government they want to align themselves. And look at the benefits the Egyptians are now enjoying under the new crypto-military regime. For starters, it's far more efficient than that of the prior elderly president for life. Just look at the number of civilians that have been killed, the death sentences meted out to the elected president and his cronies, and the free press enjoyed by the Egyptian press as long as it's in exile. Coup? What coup? I don't know, Davy. I don't see no coup. Thanks, Goliath. Oh, nice reference, Philip. But still, we just got to do something militarily to stop the beheadings and extremist Wahhabism that are hallmarks of the Islamist regime in Saudi Arabia, Iraq and Syria. Damn, I get so confused. It's so hard to keep out despotic extremist allies, or keep them apart from our despotic extremist enemies. But then it all comes down to Israel, right? Here's what I want to know, notwithstanding King Hussein's fluent English and Gentile personality. When we speak of a two-state solution for the Palestinian issue, why don't we note that the West Bank was ruled by a Hashemite minority in Jordan prior to 1967, or that Jordan is 70% Palestinian? I guess because then it could mean we'd have to tell our third favorite Middle Eastern ally after Israel and Egypt that an equitable solution would be a state comprised of the West Bank, sans any settlements, and the East Bank. Of course, a two-bank solution would be unpalatable to a party that doesn't even want a government-run bank in this country. As much as I am a critic of Netanyahu and the Israeli government, Israel has Palestinian citizens, while most of its Arab neighbors have refused to grant citizenship to the children and grandchildren of Palestinian refugees born within their borders and have either declared war against or expelled the PLO from within their territories during my lifetime. I don't know, Bob, to the second power. I'll concede the third power to Ron. But I'm just wondering if the Arab support of the Palestinian cause is just a bit suspect and far more anti-Israeli than pro-Palestinian and has escaped scrutiny because of our energy needs. If Barack Hussein Obama is a secret Muslim supporting the jihadists by sending numerous sorties to bomb the Islamic State, then I'm willing to recognize that Cromwell was a Guinness-loving, Irish-speaking, devout Catholic in the old country willing to love the Pope and swallow the wafer like the rest of my folks. Ooh, them's fighting words. I'll end by noting that I am aghast at what happened in Paris. I speak French and love French culture, but then these ugly memories of Algeria and Pied Noir and Arab slums in France keep cropping up. It would be so nice if, when we rightly decry these horrors, we try, too, to understand the history that has fomented so much hatred and disconnect. Rather, fight another war to end all wars and end up with so many dead civilians on all sides, and maybe seek another resolution that will discern between legitimate grievances and horrific acts, and try to resolve the former to prevent the latter. Philip, my friend, that is too rational and too reasonable by at least 75%. Hey, I bet we've got Jim over on line one. Hey, Jim.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Reasonably well. I enjoyed the bumper music. We've talked about her before, Grace Jones. And for those of you who'd like to hear it again, the CD is called Portfolio.
Grace Jones, Portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It brings back a lot of memories.
I thought, I was pretty sure that was Grace Jones.
Pretty sure? You couldn't tell?
It's not like I've got the discography here, Jim.
Bob, I remember when Peter Gobbo started his show and you and Agnes and I were talking, and I was the Wicked Witch of the North and he was the Wicked Witch of the South. And that and Bronski Beat and Grace Jones were the things that I told you guys that he ought to play when he was going to start his show.
Bronski Beat, dear God, there's a blast from the past.
Mm-hmm. Ball-tied boy. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of good music in those days, and I've always liked Grace Jones. I even met her in Fire Island.
Did you really?
Mm-hmm. Sure did. As a matter of fact, her coiffure was French-driven. you know, when she played Mayday and all those roles in the James Bond films and stuff like that, and was in the Arnold Schwarzenegger
thing. Yeah, see, it's her role in what was that? Conan the Librarian, I think.
Number two.
Yeah, that's the one I remember.
Mm-hmm. When she took she gave out a couple cans of whoop-ass for that staff of hers. But she's an incredible entertainer. She really is. And, you know, just an activist in a lot of good causes, AIDS and things of that nature. And so, as a matter of fact, that disc is in my carousel. And a lot of times when I want to remember the old days and sort of feeling a little low, I'll just put it on and listen to it. And I can play it. Certainly am.
Well, I was gonna go for the original Edith Piaf version.
Well, no, I don't think that would have worked.
But I admit I was looking for that's only like 3 minutes and 9 seconds, and I was looking for something a little more Stairway to Heaven-ish.
Okay, well, that was a good selection, even if so by happenstance. So what else do you have going on tonight besides all these things?
Golly Moses, this is a treasure trove of, well, I mean, it's Titanic Tuesday after all, and we'd focus on right-wing attempts at cognition. And this is a treasure trove of right-wing stupid. All it takes honest to God, if an ISIS terrorist farts in the Paris underground, it's World War III to these clowns. And let them kill a bunch of people, and well. But the thing is, I noticed our buddy Jug of Punch sent me a commentary from Digby. I don't know if you ever read Hullabaloo, but Digby's awesome. And she pointed out that, you know, all the major news outlets are referring to this guy that's being sought as the mastermind of Paris. And Digby just pointed out that, you know, getting your hands on, if you're a terrorist, getting your hands on some dynamite belts and AK-47s and picking out a restaurant, a concert hall, and a soccer stadium aren't exactly deeply nuanced, highly strategic efforts. And I think she's right. But what other stuff do I have? I got a great piece of audio from Bernie Sanders. And this is one of those things where you listen to the audio and you just ask yourself, and I'm not trying to go negative here, but you just ask yourself, can you imagine Hillary Clinton ever saying this? I mean, just listen to this clip, Jim. You're gonna love it.
Proceed.
We are disgusted by the attack against the people of Paris by the terrorists. And I know that I speak for everyone here and everyone in our country when we send our condolences to the families who lost loved ones in that barbaric attack, and our prayers go out for speedy recoveries for the many hundreds who were injured. In my view, now is the time for developing an effective strategy to destroy ISIS. Now is not the time for cheap political talk or trying to take political advantage of this difficult moment.
It gets even better.
Now is the time, as President Obama is trying to do, to unite the world in an organized campaign against ISIS by bringing together all of the countries who have common interest in the international terrorism, even countries that we have disagreements with. So I think what the president correctly is trying to do is bring together our European, Germany, Kingdom, and others, along with Russia, and along with the Muslim countries who are today face-to-face with ISIS. Is an international coalition including Iran and Saudi Arabia, Jordan and Kuwait and Turkey. Now, putting together this coalition is not going to be easy, given the many hostilities and long-seated disagreements that some of these countries face. But that is what President Obama and Secretary Kerry do their efforts. Let me also say that now demagogue and fear-mongering.
Here it comes.
If the moment terrorism is about is trying to instill terror and fear into the hearts of people. And we will not let that happen. As Americans, we will not be terrorized. We will not live in fear. And I do, by some of what I am hearing from my Republic, these difficult times, as Americans, we will not succumb to racism. Yeah. We will not allow ourselves to be divided and succumb. But the shirts on their backs, we will not turn our backs on the refugees from Syria and Afghanistan. We will do what we do best, and that is be Americans fighting racism instead of fighting fear. And perhaps most important of history. Yesterday, the chairman
Well, dadgummit. You still there, Jim?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something weird is going on here.
Well, the transmission was somewhat garbled.
I've got crazy buffering going on, and I don't know why.
We didn't
get to the meat of it, and with any luck at all, maybe we eventually will, but I don't know. Strange. Well, I don't often see buffering like that.
Well, yeah.
At least not lately.
As I said before, is it crowned so it crucifies? But nonetheless, you know, fear is definitely an organizing principle. And when you hear of these things being broadcast last week about the last Friday night in six areas of Paris and that sort of thing, it makes you realize exactly how, in my opinion, these individuals who are doing this are not very nice people. And there it is, there you have it. And I think they're are centered, just tell me exactly where are they centered? I know they are basically spreading out at a horrific rate throughout the world. They have cells all over.
Well, I mean, a brief history of ISIS, Jim, goes back to dim leaders decision to attack Iraq. The people of Iraq.
As Philip recalled,
Paul Bremer's decision, which was dim leaders' decision to remove the Iraqi military and to just, you know, throw them out in the streets, when they could have actually been quite helpful in terms of maintaining some degree of stability and order.
Well, that's the thing. When you go in there, you know, when you break it, you bought it. And that's what we did. And this whole thing with the entire Arab Spring, that entire part of the world has been destabilized. And you've got a lot of people who have sprung from that who are now causing a great deal of trouble and a great deal of heartbreak. And there it is. It was a little bit better, in my humble opinion, to have left the existing regimes in power. But all of a sudden, you had this outbreak of the so-called Arab Spring, in which there were so many people who were so, well, one guy I heard, it was on this network, he said, well, I don't care what they do. I think the other person sees exactly what's been spawned out of that.
I don't remember that particular instance, but...
I do.
I don't.
I do.
Okay,
one
I don't.
Of your callers, one of your callers said that, and I thought to myself, you idiot. You don't know what the hell you are advocating there. I mean, true, these people who are in power, Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, and others... I mean, the whole area is so volatile, and, you know, and free slot before Tito. I mean, when Tito was in power, he kept that part of the world in line. And guess what happened after Tito?
Chaos.
Milosevic, the horrors of Sarajevo, and all those people who were... trying to assert their own independence, and you saw what the outcome of the Dayton Accords were. They couldn't get anybody to agree, and so, you know, unfortunately.
There are multiple prongs to this problem, and that's what makes it so difficult to get a handle on. On the one hand, at best, you got 30,000 people in what we know to be ISIS, ISIL, Daesh. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What is that on an organizational chart? That's what a battalion, a brigade. It's a brigade.
It's a division.
A division. Okay. I don't know. I knew it wasn't. It wasn't up at corps level. But
I'd say 20,000 might be a division, but closer to a division. But nonetheless, you know.
And they're scattered out, and they're not all wearing uniforms, so that's a problem.
No.
But the same thing. Remember, Napoleon said an army travels on its stomach,
right.
And that's a shorthanded way of saying you've got to be able to supply your military if you want to do anything with it. Well, it's not like that army is arising in a vast and fertile area, rich with foodstuffs. Agreed?
No, it's not. I mean,
so somebody's got to... So it's going to fund them. Because they're going to have to buy the stuff that they travel on their stomachs on. Well, for instance, you remember the story from a couple of weeks ago about the good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Green family who runs Hobby Lobby, who is probably going to get busted for trading in illegal antiquities, most deformed tablet literacy in this world?
Not really.
Well, I've remarked on it a couple of times. So they're trading in illegal antiquities to raise money. They're probably selling some illegal oil. But as much or more than that, Our partners in peace, Jim, the good headloppers, the Saudis, have been funneling money to them because as long as they're making mischief somewhere else, they're not...
Do you think that ISIL, whatever you want to call them, that their funding allocations are coming out of Saudi Arabia?
They're being funded out of Saudi Arabia. They're being funded out of the UAE. They're being funded out of Qatar. They're being funded out of the more wealthy Arab Gulf states.
Uh-huh. Well, that should tell you something right there.
And so I don't think we can count on the Saudis to send their massive military marching off into the desert.
No, not at all.
But secondarily, you know, you mentioned the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring begins in Egypt, right? And the Arab Spring begins in Egypt with bread riots. And
yeah,
the bread
under Mubarak.
Right, and the bread riots happen because a certain, if I understand correctly, a certain aspect of the law of the rules regarding trading in commodities that there had previously been a rule forbidding speculating on essential foodstuffs like grain was lifted, and of course because freedom and because capitalism, because money, we shot the price of grain up. The speculators did. And suddenly, you know, you can't get your couple of flats of bread there in Egypt. And people who are starving will begin to riot because they've nothing left.
It has definite economic roots. And, you know, people trying to take advantage of grain prices for their own, you know, enrichment. But I'll guarantee you one thing. I hope these people who contributed to the destabilization of that part of the world are happy now, and I hope that whatever money they made from it, they're going to enjoy.
Just watch the daily fluctuations in the price of a barrel of oil, Jim. If it goes up, they're happy.
Well, that's just something we've just become addicted to. I mean, you know, it's just, as far as oil is concerned, Bob, there's more than just petroleum, discs and things of that nature. I mean, look how much a modern society now depends upon oil.
Sure.
Plastics, fertilizers, all this kinds of stuff. And I don't see any substitutes that are being generated.
They are out there. People, the research is being done. The products are being developed. For instance, I've got some. You ever seen those little styrofoam peanuts? The packing peanuts, right?
I hate those damn things. God knows I do. If somebody sends me a package of one of those things in them, I want to send it back because the minute you open it, it explodes.
Well, one of the things that's been developed, for instance, that's all styrofoam. That's a hydrocarbon product. That's an oil product, right? Well, it turns out you can make it out of cornstarch, and they dissolve when water hits them. I mean, we're not locked into a hydrocarbon death spiral. We can find our way out if we want to. But the point I was making a moment ago, Jim, is that if you, as Bart Kopp used to note, if you see someone making a mistake, and every time they make that mistake, they make more money, after a while you begin to... Every time something goes bump in the Middle East, the world price of a barrel of crude goes up. And so chaos in the Middle East means higher oil prices, which means more money in the pockets of ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch Shell and BP, etc., etc., etc. And you begin to see a little bit of a relationship going on there.
Well, you know, my question is simply this. What is going to be the substitute for oil? How much R&D has been done on that?
It's being done every day. Like I said the other night, in terms of American energy independence, the biggest patriot in this country may be Elon Musk. The man took every one of his patents relating to electric vehicles and put them into the public domain, made them open sourced. And you will eventually see I forget which manufacturer it was, that they said, you know, in another couple of decades, their entire fleet will be electric, not internal combustion.
How will they be lubricated? Graphite?
You can make lubricants out of things other than hydrocarbons.
Well, I'm just asking. I mean, you know, I know graphite is a lubricant and was considered to be one particular source, but I guess what I'm trying to say.
I mean, I don't think that the usage of oil will ever go completely away. We're going to have to. I mean, just like coal, you kind of got to have coal to make high quality steel. But if you've got to have coal to make high-quality steel, that argues against just burning it willy-nilly for thermal power, or for thermal value. Because you never get the most you can get out of the thermal value of a ton of coal is like 30%. And that's wildly inefficient. So if we're going to need these things, and we know these things are finite, and we know that we don't have as much of it as we'd maybe like to have, then we have to burn it judiciously.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you're gonna need some of these things for the processes that produce the wind turbines and the solar panels.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, these materials are hydrocarbon based.
You know, but in the final analysis, there's that phrase again, which I find annoying. But I think we have to note like I said, Marty pointed out on the program last night, Bob, not all petroleum is used for gasoline, and I said, well, no, you know, that consider Velveeta. But the fact of the matter is, the vast majority of it is burned as internal combustion fuel. The vast majority of it, and it doesn't have to be that way. We can reduce that. You know, simply having wise public transportation in this country would be a humongous leap forward.
Well, you see where that's going.
Well, right now, sure.
It's not going anywhere, really. I mean,
because you've got a lot of politicians who are paid to keep it from going anywhere. I go back to certain moments of idiocy. There they were in Wisconsin with a Spanish firm that had already built a plant there to construct, intra-city railway cars. And there was a plan for interstate rail between places like Milwaukee and Chicago, and Chicago and Cleveland, and Cleveland, Detroit, that kind of thing. Scott Walker gets into the into office in Wisconsin and says, "Oh hell no, we don't want that transportation money to support that interstate rail." And the Spanish rail car company said, "Well, if that's the case, we're leaving." And Scott Walker said, "But what about the jobs?" And they said, "Dumbass, you just killed the jobs."
Well, that's true. But, you know, public transportation, is simply not as, well, in larger cities, yeah, you have subways and things of that nature, and you have the metro in Washington, and you have in New York and other larger cities, the BART in San Francisco, but basically, you know, remember when cities used to have streetcars?
I can't remember it per se, but I'm aware of the era.
Well, I didn't think you ever rode a streetcar.
I mean, actually, I have. I've ridden them in New Orleans, and I've ridden the cable cars in San Francisco.
Well, I have too, but I'm talking about, I mean, you know, in this little town of Beckley. They used to have streetcars here.
Yeah. The little town I grew up in had, when I was a little kid, you could still see the remnants of the tracks running down the middle of Court Street.
That's right. That's right. I remember, you know, those things all went out of vogue when people were being able to get in their internal combustion driven cars and just go when and where they wanted to. But, you know, that's, I guess, maybe something that we can look back with a certain degree of fondness. And, I don't know. These are very difficult questions. And in spite of what R&D is being done, it's going to take a long, long time to replace the love affair that people have with the internal combustion engine and the transition to electric cars.
Well, but there, I agree to a certain extent, Jim, but being difficult is not the same thing as being impossible.
Oh, well.
Quite often, being difficult makes it a matter of determination and will.
Well, that's the key element right there.
Impossible means, you know, figuring out a way to violate the laws of nature.
Well, you know, what I'm saying, you have you know, a great deal of force that wants to keep the R&D suppressed, and they want to remain prisoners of the petrochemical industry. There it is, you know. It's not going to happen overnight, that's for sure. It's just not. And it's not in the immediate future.
No, it's coming. It's coming in other places faster than here, but it is coming.
How long would you say it would take?
A generation. A generation.
20 years?
Yeah, I think I'm in more biblical terms, 40. And depending on what happens with the changing demographics in the United States, we could begin to see a more meaningful transition starting, say, January 2023. That's my target date.
Based upon what?
Based upon the changing face of America.
I mean, and why the sense 2023?
Because that's the midterm elections after the next census, which is going to see significant change in the populational makeup of this country.
I just ask. I mean, you know, when you start dealing with numbers and things of that nature, it's, for me, it's just kind of hard to pinpoint exactly when the watershed date will be.
As Carol Baker points out, streetcars are coming back even in a place like Kansas City. She says our first one was delivered last week.
Well, that's good in Kansas City. That's a major city. Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to hear that.
But, Jim, I got to get out of here because we're up against it.
I have to get out of here, too.
Have yourself a good evening. I'm glad you called in and enjoyed the conversation.
Enjoy the bumper music.
All right. You take care.
Good night.
Bye now. And it is. It's time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody, for joining in. Thank you. Thank you to Bob and to Asa and to Thomas and to Philip for answering $300 of Chris's $500 challenge. Much appreciated. Thanks to our buddy Gary Laborman and to Greg for making three out of the 10 folks that whose first month of subscription contribution will be doubled by Tony and Chico. Thank you everybody for not saying that guy's name. That's four nights in a row almost. Yeah, yay. And Carol is happy to have sponsored four nights of You Know Who Free Radio. Thanks, Carol. And it is now time to get out of here. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky, in the chat room, even if we weren't able to. That's really screwy. I found out later on that it works on the mobile version. It just doesn't work on the ordinary version. We'll continue to work to try to get that sorted out. And thanks to Greg for letting us use the Malloy chat room. Much appreciated there. Thanks to all of you for spending your precious finite time in sharing in this conversation. Remember, no program tomorrow night because we've got a massive load of engineering going on in here. I'm sorry, but it's necessary. And hopefully folks will do the last $200 of Chris's challenge and we can get out in front of, yeah, okay, great, awesome. Always, Gina, it's all for you.